to open up to Matthew chapter 10. As we've been going through the instruction that Jesus has given to the 12 apostles through really all of Matthew chapter 10, and if you think back to verse 5, where he says, these 12 Jesus sent out after instructing them. And then if you look at chapter 11, verse 1, it says, when Jesus had finished giving instruction to his 12 disciples, you realize that all of Matthew chapter 10 is really about this encounter of him instructing them before they get sent out. We've already looked through so many aspects of this, of where they're to go in terms of what people's to encounter, about going to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, about really what the message is, about repent for the kingdom of God, is the kingdom of heaven is at hand. You see all these things about him beginning to instill within them, you're going to have to rely upon God to take care of you. Whenever you go, don't take all this extra money or money bags or extra sandals and things. He says, you're going to have to rely upon God to take care of you. You're going to go into cities, and some of them are going to take care of you really well. Others are going to completely reject you, and you have to understand they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And sometimes we let that become really personal to us. And he says, you're going to have to go out with wisdom, and you're going to have to be as wise as serpents and as innocent as doves. And to have that kind of wisdom, you're going to have to listen to your shepherd. You're going to have to listen to what Jesus is telling you. And he's giving them that instruction right here, right now. And then to go, if they won't receive you, says, take back the blessing, shake the dust off your feet, and move on to the next city. He says, you won't finish going through all the cities before basically says, before I do what I'm going to do in terms of his death. Then, as we went on through last week, to see some of these other things about, don't fear what they can do to you. Don't worry, I'll give you the words. Whenever you get called in before these courts and in these synagogues, he says, you had better fear the one who can kill both body and soul. He's saying, you better fear my Father. You better fear God. And let that be your fear. And then we finished up last week about seeing about how we're valued. This idea, and my mom's the one who brought it up, talks about, he even knows the number of the hairs on your head. You think about how often hairs fall out and regrow and to go, and yet he knows the number continuously. And who would think that anybody would even care about such a thing? And that should tell us how well he knows us. And he knows what we need. And he's not going to hold back what we need. Now, we finished up in verses 32 and 33 last week about you confess me before men and I will confess you before my Father. You deny me before men, I will deny you before my Father. And to realize, knowing this moment is coming, and for these 12, at least one of them is going to be denied. Judas in the end is not going to endure to the end. And it's going to cost him. And Jesus gave him the instruction. And yet he still made his choice. Then you come to verse 34 and you see maybe a different aspect of the way you think about Jesus. He says, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Do you ever think about Jesus whenever he came? I know this is not verbatim what it says, but he came to pick a fight. That is not really the way we think about him, is it? But I want you to notice what he's saying. He says, I didn't come to bring peace. And he's talking about, I didn't come so that all the earth would be reconciled. I know that's not going to happen. He's dealing in reality. I don't know if you ever, you know, see some of these pageants where they give out prize money for scholarships or different things. And then they always come to this interview question. And they go, you know, what do you want? What would you do? And what do they all say? World peace. Which tells you one thing in particular. Have they ever read Matthew chapter 10, verse 34? Because what is Jesus said is not going to happen. He says, this is not going to be world peace. So don't expect it. And especially here, he's saying, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. He says, I came to bring a sword. Whenever you hear that, what do you think of? It's going to be a fight. I mean, in order to have a war, you have to have two people who want something different. Right? Because if they want the same thing, what will they have? Peace. Unless it's self-centered. But you notice here what he really brings out here, and to see the sword aspect. And yet, is he really talking about, okay, we're going to fight this out with guns and swords and knives? And no. He's talking about something far different. And I want you to consider a couple of passages real quick, and just to see exactly where this sword's going to cut. Look at Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. Look at verses 16 and 17. Paul writes to these Galatian people, saints. Galatians 5:16. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. You know, there's two opposing sides here. Which way are you going to walk in your life? Going to walk by the flesh? Self-centered, self-serving, self-seeking, going to walk by the Spirit, desiring God to do things God's way, His will, not mine. Then verse 17, he says, for the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. Do you notice it's not just one way? He doesn't say, now this is really just a flesh problem. He says, no, you need to understand, flesh stands in opposition to Spirit. And in the same way, the Spirit sets in opposition to flesh. If Spirit starts to say, let's just get along, I'll give myself over to do things that maybe aren't right just for the sake of peace. Is that what Jesus is trying to encourage? Not at all. He's saying, do you realize you're at war? Does you realize there's a sword? And keep in mind, he's talking specifically to these 12 at the moment. He says, you're going out there and people will reject you. And they're really rejecting me. They're really rejecting my Father. But you need to understand, if you're expecting to be everybody's friend, you're not standing in opposition to flesh. And sometimes that's a little hard to swallow. Because we don't really like being treated ugly because of standing to do what's right. Now, notice here he goes on. He says, for the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, for these are in opposition to one another, so that you may not do the things that you please or you wish. He says, because what do we generally want to happen? We want things to work out in a peaceful solution, right? And he's saying, you've got to do things the way the Spirit desires. You have to do things in a way that's pleasing to God. And he brings up here, he says, they're in opposition to one another. He says, and you have to decide, do I really want to walk by the Spirit, which means automatically going to get a lot of enemies? Or am I going to walk by the flesh and go, I can make friends pretty easy? I mean, how easy is it? Just a quick example. Maybe you're in a long line at the supermarket. Everybody's complaining about how long it's taking. How come these people don't work faster? Why don't they get another person up here on the register? What's going on with them? And you're having to wait too. What is the flesh telling you to do? Get mad, get impatient, just like the people around you. Just become fleshly, be self-centered. Think about just your time and what you're doing. And you go, it's so easy to want to fit in, isn't it? It's easy to say, oh, yeah, I wish they would, as opposed to going, do you see how hard that lady's working up there to try and check these people out? Do you see the difficulty of it? We become a people who want to be fleshly at times, as opposed to being someone who is trying to do what's spiritually better. Now, you see how things start to work together in terms of what's here. And then you get to this idea so that you don't do what you please, because it's real easy to want to fit in. Now, look back at Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. You'll see the same kind of language. And I just want us to see what the sword is really about. Romans chapter 8. Look at verse 5. Similar type of conversation going on here. Of course, it's Paul writing Romans just as well as the book of Galatians by inspiration. He says, "For those who are according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who are according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit." A mindset. He says, mindset. Verse 6, "For the mindset on the flesh is death, but the mindset on the Spirit is life and peace." Now, which outcome do we want? Oh, he says life and peace. You mean you can actually have peace in the midst of being at war? He says, you're not going to make peace with the opposition, but you can have peace within yourself. Because who do you know you're standing with? You're going to stand with God. You're going to stand with Jesus. You're going to stand by the spiritual mindset. And he says, this is life and peace. To be friends with the world in terms of going, I'm going to sacrifice my character to fit in, to have peace with them. What does that set me up with God? Who's going to be my enemy now? Lord will. Now, notice how it continues. Verse 7. Because the mindset on the flesh is hostile toward God. I'm not going to be told what to do. What do you mean I got to be patient and gentle and kind? Forgiving. Yeah, people get hostile. What makes you think I should forgive them? Don't you know what they did to me? What kind of mindset is it? It's flesh and it's hostile. Now, he continues on. He says, flesh is hostile toward God, for it does not subject itself to the law of God. I'm not going to do it God's way. Then he says, for it is not even able to do so. The fleshly mindset will never do what God desires. In terms of being led by the Spirit, God still stands in control. Don't mistake that. Then verse 8 says, for those who are in the flesh cannot please God. Notice it says cannot, not will not. It says it is impossible in the fleshly mindset to please God. Which should tell us something. How vital. To make sure that we're going to walk by the Spirit and strive to have a selfless mindset of the will of God. Even if it means I have to go through things that are difficult. Let's see, did Jesus ever have to go through things that were difficult because he was going to have a spiritual mindset? Yeah, like every day. And yet what did he show us? Can it be done? Can you work off of the power of God? Yes. If we'll draw near to him. Now, you see what's at hand here. Come back to Matthew chapter 10. So in verse 34, he says, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I'm not coming here for everybody to get on the same page. I know that's not going to happen. Now, did he want that to happen? He desires for all men to be saved, to repent, to come to God. He says, but I know that's not going to happen. Did Jesus know that wasn't going to happen? He sure did. You remember the story that we've already been through in the Sermon on the Mount? He says, you know what? There's a way that's broad and there's a way that's narrow. He says, and the way that's broad is going to have many folks, and the one that's narrow is going to be found by just a few folks. So what did he already know? A lot of them aren't going to be going after spiritual things. So this is that aspect of sometimes it shouldn't be comforting that we're in the majority. Sometimes. There are situations. But realize this, if we're going to try and fit in with everybody, we're probably not falling on the right side of spiritual things. Now, in the midst of being in that long waiting line, God needs somebody to show what a spiritual mindset looks like. And what's so funny is sometimes the people who complain the most are wearing the shirts and they have the jewelry of the cross and all these things. And you go, huh, what's going on here? Is this just outward or is it inward? And you realize, and I'm not saying something negative about that, but just realize if we're going to claim to be God's people, then we sure better act like Him. Even whenever nobody else will. The opportunities are present. Now here he was, and then all of a sudden this becomes really personal. And you think about it, he's talking to an audience of 12. And at least two sets of brothers, maybe three sets of brothers in this group. And then you get to verse 35. He says, "For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household." Oh. Sometimes I look at the order of how Jesus puts things. And maybe there's times there's more stock in it than others. But it seems in verses 32 and 33, he makes that solid, sobering point first. Say, just remember, if you deny me, I'll have to deny you. If you confess me, then you can know by promise that I will confess you before my Father. And then the next thought in verses 34 through 36 is about a choice of what? What about if it divides your own home? And he says, "I came to set a man against his father." You kind of imagine for these men, we know some of their fathers. James and John are the son of Zebedee. And they go, "You mean we might have to make a spiritual stand against our own father?" Think about Peter and Andrew. They left their father to come follow Jesus. He says, what if he doesn't accept who I am as the Messiah, as the Son of God? Are you going to confess me or will you deny me? Now, I know we have difficult family situations. And you go, what does God expect of us? All. Total dedication to Him. Now, it's not that we aim to be, you know, offensive. But sometimes whenever we feel like our family relationships break down, we typically look on the inside and go, what did I do wrong? And sometimes it's not because we did something wrong. It's because we did something right. Now, it can be done in the wrong spirit. Don't get me wrong here. I don't take this the wrong way. But going, sometimes we feel defeated when we've actually succeeded. And it's because it really hasn't come out of a place of refined faith. And understand what Jesus is saying here. Because then he comes to these other relationships. Man against his father. A daughter against her mother. And if you notice, it can fit both ways. Because now he's making an application even beyond just the 12. He's saying, what about mothers who have to make decisions about whether they're going to really hold to what's spiritually good to the offense of their own daughter? What if you're the daughter and this is your mother? And to say, are you really going to confess me before men? Are you really going to hold to be spiritually minded? Not to be reckless with words, not for things to spew out of anger, but for words to come out of love and compassion and kindness and mercy. And he says, and you think about these relationships, which sometimes even get kind of colored with a difficult color. He says, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. You talk about what can be sometimes very, very difficult relationships. He says, one thing for sure as a daughter-in-law and as a mother-in-law of saying, will I be spiritually minded? Will I be forgiving? Will I be patient? Can I have joy even when things aren't going the best? And remember what this is tied to. He who confesses me. And if you notice it in verse 32, he says, therefore, everyone who confesses me. So that was not just a statement just for the 12. That was a statement for everyone. So he brings these things out. He says, daughter-in-law against your mother-in-law. And it doesn't matter which role you are in here, whether you're the mother or the daughter or the daughter-in-law or the mother-in-law in the relationship. What he's bringing together is saying, you have to understand, I've called you to walk according to what's spiritually right and to listen to the shepherd and obey his voice. Then he noticed in verse 36, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. And that is such a difficult battle when it's people in your own household. I think about parents who have children who are teenagers who haven't come to Christ yet. And boy, sometimes they can become so trying, rebellious, really harsh and sharp in how they talk. And to go, and do you know what God's wanting from a mother and a father? I need somebody who'll be spiritually minded. I need you to show them what that looks like while they're walking according to the flesh. He says, will you confess me before them? And that doesn't mean, hey, I'm confessing that Jesus is Lord. He says, no, will you show patience? Will you show mercy whenever their heart turns? Will you show them compassion? And you realize, he says, because then you're fighting with me together. We're working together against the flesh. As opposed to, if you're going to be fleshly just like them, how are you going to lead them out into something spiritual? Did you treat me the same way? You yell back at me. You throw your tantrum just like I do. And you see Jesus saying, I came to bring a sword. I came to pick a fight. It's time for you to choose your side. Are you going to be with me or against me? And of course, Judas, we know what he's going to choose. And we know that some of these other men are going to, they're going to stumble along the way too. Carla. Right. It carries a different picture. Right now. And you realize this is an instruction that he's giving. And some of these things aren't going to happen for 3 or 4 years. Some are going to happen really quickly. And so you see how he builds these things together. Look back at where this is quoted from. Look back at Micah. I want you to see where this is quoted out of and really as to why. Micah chapter 7. Micah writes during the times of the kings of Judah, specifically three kings in particular. The first one is Jotham. He's king for 16 years in Judah. He's a good king. The next king is for another 16 years, the name of Ahaz. He is evil. He's a wicked king. And then 29 years, he prophesies during the days of Hezekiah, who is a wonderful king. And so here it is in the midst of all these things going on, probably more so at this time in Micah chapter 7, during the days of Hezekiah, when times are good. Micah 7, look at the first verse. And this is what God tells him to write. Woe is me, for I am like the fruit pickers, like the grape gatherers. Doesn't that sound, he says, starts off with a woe, but he says, you know what, I'm like a fruit picker. Well, if you've been out picking fruit, that's kind of a good day typically, right? We're going to pull off some raspberries or some grapes or some strawberries, and you go, that's going to work out pretty good. But here's the problem. He says, there's not a cluster of grapes to eat or a first ripe fig, which I crave. He says, there's no grapes to eat. They never made it to anything that's good. They're already spoiled. And if you notice the way he talks about it, or a first ripe fig, which I crave. I don't know, have you ever looked at bad fruit? You ever gone to the grocery store, look at the produce, and all of a sudden you go, why do they even put this stuff out to sale? This is pretty bad stuff. I guess they haven't come along yet this morning. And you don't say that to everybody else because that'd be a wrong attitude. But you think about it on the inside. And you go, okay, something broke down. And so you start looking, and here he is. He says, there's nothing here worthwhile. Verse 2, the godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among men. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. He says, you look around Judah, and what do you find spiritually? Nothing worthwhile. He says, godly people are no longer here in the land. He says, there's no upright person among men. He says, they just lie. They'll kill each other. They don't care. He says, they hunt the other with a net. Verse 3, concerning evil, both hands do it well. He says, they're not just one. They're ambidextrous when it comes to doing evil. He says, they're not just partial. He says, both hands do it well. The prince asks, and also the judge for a bribe. He says, all of a sudden you look around, even the people. He says, and I wonder at this point if he wasn't referring back. Do you remember Ahaz? He was wicked. He says, they take a bribe. And when judges start taking bribes, what does that tell you about justice? It goes to the highest bidder. That's who it goes to. And if you're poor, you're poor all the way through. Because nobody's going to stand up for you in the leadership. Then he says, halfway through verse 3, and a great man speaks the desire of his soul, so they weave it together. He says, a great man, and he's talking about kings and judges, and princes. He says, you know what? This is what they want, and so they find a way to weave it through the judges to make a few payments so that they get what they want. I know it says soul, but don't think that's something positive here. Then he says, so they weave it together, the bribes and what they want. Verse 4, the best of them is like a briar, the most upright like a thorn hedge. You ever had to get to the other side of a thorn hedge? I mean, you think about trying to get to the other side, it's pretty bad. And you go, this is the way it is. He says, the best of them is a briar. That's the best. What does that tell you about the worst? Woo! Verse 4. The day when you post your watchman, your punishment will come. He says, you can be looking out for it, and guess what's still coming? Punishment's coming. You're not going to mock God. Then, which once again, what are you seeing? Is this all about people who are working off of a spiritual mindset or a fleshly mindset? Flesh. Oh, I wonder how this judgment's going to go for them. Not well. Then, he continues on. He says, your punishment will come, then their confusion will occur. Verse 5, do not trust in a neighbor, do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. Now, remember, people who do evil with both hands, he says, you can't trust your neighbor. They just as soon kill you. He says, they're not going to be honest with you. He says, don't have confidence in a friend. He says, oh, but they're my good friend. And they'll stab you in the back. Because that's what fleshly people do. They'll use you until they don't need you anymore. And then who cares? Then he says, from her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. And you can take that one both ways. Even you can't even trust your own wife. Now, it could also be something much worse here. It could be an adulterous situation, but he doesn't bring that up. Verse 6. Then we come to our quotation out of Matthew 10. He says, for son treats father contemptuously. He will not show his father honor. In how many homes are the parents not shown honor? Does that ever turn out well without change? No. He says, daughter rises up against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. And what made them such great enemies? It's the fleshly self mindset. He says, that's the sword that's cutting between. And so often, whenever our families break down in relationship, we feel so defeated. And we wonder, how did this happen? I'm striving to do what's right. But you're dealing with people who are fleshly minded. And so we shouldn't even expect peace. We should realize, okay, I've got to walk according to what's Christ-like. Then notice verse 7, because he turns it over. He says, but as for me, well, who's this? This is Micah. Here I am in the midst of a situation like this. I can't trust my neighbor. Maybe can't even trust my wife. Not even my friends. People want to tear me down. He says, but as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. So what's the proper response? Whenever you realize, you know what, I have this family dynamic and it's not working out very well. Because their mindset is not one that's Christ-like. Is mine Christ-like, number one? And then going, what's the right response? Will I be patient? And really to have a moment of clarity to go, how long did God have to wait for me? How long was he patient for me to have a mindset change? And you realize real quickly of, I have no excuse to not be patient. And wouldn't you know it, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace with God, not with man. Love, joy, peace, patience. Shouldn't we be a patient people? You're kind enough to show kindness. I'm going to treat you well even though you don't treat me well. Isn't this a spiritual mindset? Now, I know it goes on in terms of faithfulness, self-control. How often in these situations do you desperately need self-control? Because there's things your lips wants to say, but you know you better not say it because it's not going to be kind the way you say it. You know, I need to have self-control. Then he says, but as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I'm going to wait upon his hand. I'll be patient. I'll wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. He says, he's attentive to where I am, the difficulties. He says, do not rejoice over me, O my enemy. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. Is this the way Jesus thought? Did he have enemies among his own household? His brothers and sisters, were they all in on, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're the Messiah? No, they said, he's out of his mind. I mean, they literally said that. There's no sense left in it. And yet, what did he choose to do? I'll keep on doing what God wants. And I'm going to do his will. And I'm going to walk by the Spirit. And in the end, how does it turn out? Don't we know of some of his own half-brothers who turned to the Lord? Does Jesus understand those family dynamics? He's not just giving instruction on, now here's how you should do it. He's saying, I'm walking in this too. Now, come back over to the Matthew chapter 10. And it talks about, he says, I may fall, but I'm going to rise. It certainly doesn't make you think about death, burial, and resurrection. He says, he'll take care of me. Karen. Right. Right. And you see that encouragement as being part of the body of Christ among one another. So here in Matthew 10, you see how the quotation works in verse 35 and 36 from Micah. Then verse 37, he takes it even further. He said, just in case you're unaware, he says, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And I want you to realize, both times in verse 37, he says, he who loves. Now, I always try to have you guess because I want you to see how the word gets used. Which word for love do you think that is, phileo or agape? It's phileo. Good job. It's, you see, if you would rather have fellowship, a connection with your family, rather than this connection with God, realize there is an aspect, when we talk about the agape love, there is a phileo of love too. To want to share in the divine nature of who God is in character. To see, here's Jesus walking by the Spirit. Do I phileo him to want to walk by the Spirit too? He says, is there a tender, fond connection? He's saying, if that connection is not with me, is not with God, he says, and instead it's with your father or your mother, you go, oh, I can't do that. He says, that would completely destroy my parents. They would hate me. They would cut me off from the family. And if that's the case, what does Jesus have to say? He says, you're not worthy of me. And this is that worthy term again of, he says, you're not walking worthy of what I'm doing and what I have done. And you realize in that too, he says, he who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. In other words, he who denies me before men, I will also deny before my father. Now, it doesn't mean those things can't change later where we go, that was so fleshly of me to do that. And you change and you all of a sudden you change the whole trajectory of things to now become someone who confesses. I'm going to walk in what's spiritual. So he says, he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Well, you can't expect me to discipline my children. Well, you can't expect me to actually hold my grandchildren to a standard of what's right. He says, you going to deny me or are you going to confess me? And you realize, he says, do you love them more than you love me? He says, I need someone to walk as an example of being spiritually minded. He says, that's how people change. What's interesting is how often, and I see this in congregations all across America, where they go, we want to engage sinners on where we go, we can connect. We want to have fellowship with you. And you realize we're going to sacrifice the standard to God to do that? Did Jesus reach out to sinners? All the time. Did he say, you know, truth doesn't matter. You just come on however you want to. You can stay the way you are. You don't have to change. What are you saying? Juanita says, give me your money. But you realize this aspect of going, who do you really want to draw near to? And there's a right way to do it, to engage. I'm going to walk in what's spiritually good. And there are a lot of times Jesus says things that we go, ooh. I mean, he's talking to the woman, Samaritan woman at the well, and he says, go get your husband. She says, I don't have a husband. He says, you're right. He says, you've been married 5 times and you live with somebody else you're not even married to. That's usually not the introduction remarks we're looking for, right? But you realize, here are these situations. I mean, other ones that we know are in Matthew about the Syrophoenician woman. He says, I wasn't called for the Gentiles. He says, I'm not going to go to the dogs. Oof. That's a harsh interaction. But she shows faith. And she listens to his words. And I'm not saying we should strive to be offensive. Don't think that. But going, are we really going to stand on the principles of being spiritually minded to walk according to Christ? Now, he says, he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Verse 38, and he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. Now, I really want you to dig in here. And we're going to talk about what Carla brought up. Let's look at it. Now, and then we'll look at it down the road. Right now, cross to them means what? It's a curse. It's a judgment, right? The crucifixion was a judgment by the Roman Empire to destroy people who were either in opposition to their control. If you remember, Barabbas was going to be crucified. And what was he going to be crucified for? Being an insurrection, he was trying to take over the government in a violent way as a murderer. And that's who Jesus gets traded for. And you go, as a crucifixion was against also thieves. We know that aspect of it because they weren't going out there patrolling everything. They said, you know what, if you want to be a thief, you come into Jerusalem and you look at these men who are being crucified. He says, that's what's coming for you. You need to change your mind on robbing people. It was an intimidation aspect. And so as part of that, you realize, oh, look at what's here. So for them to say, in terms of here, the one who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He says, even if it means standing up against the governing authorities. In terms of they reject you for doing what is right. Now there, make sure you understand that part. It's not about, oh, I just go against the government, no big deal. You know Romans 13 is not going to stand for that. Why is Jesus crucified by the Romans? What did the Romans want with the Jews? Peace. They wanted for things to come together well. They didn't want the Jews to work in opposition to what the Romans were doing. And so the Jews say, here's someone that he says you don't have to pay taxes. Now, he never said that. He's the one who causes trouble. He says he's king. He's not standing with Caesar. And they go, okay. And you see him take him on. And even though later on we're going to see Herod and Pilate, they figure it out really quick that this man hadn't done anything wrong. But what's the crowd doing? Crucify him! Crucify him! What are we going to do to keep the peace between us? We'll sacrifice the Son of God. And realize, wow. That's how far people will go to maintain relationships. Crucify Jesus. And it makes you rethink and go, am I willing to be crucified with him? Am I willing to stand with him? Even if it means to be killed. Because you don't fear the ones who kill the body. You fear those who kill, who can kill the body and the soul. Now, are these men going to have to deal with those kind of situations? They are. Now, notice what else is. He says, he who does not take his cross, and probably for us, this is the idea of any kind of burden, any kind of difficulty, whether it be a medical one, whether it be something here about a family one, whether it be about situations that are really bleak and dark. He says, he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. If you have a cross, does that mean God has rejected you? No. If you have a burden, that does not mean God has left you alone. It means you can rely upon him to carry you through. And he may even use other humans to encourage and to help you. As Jesus is carrying his cross out to Calvary, his physical strength is gone. And they pull someone out of the crowd. A man by the name of Simon of Cyrene. And Mark's account actually tells you a little detail. He says, this is the father of Rufus and Alexander, as if to say, you already know these men. You know their father. And so here's a man that God uses to help get his son to the cross to die. God's still at work. Then, notice the last statement here in verse 39. We'll finish here. He who has found his life will lose it. You want to do things your way? You want to maintain your family relationships, even if it means compromising your relationship with God? He says, he who has found his life, what's going to happen in the end? And lose it. You're going to deny me before men? I'll deny you before my Father. I want you to really think about this one. We know that scene that we kind of ended with last class. To stand before God and for him to be able to say, I see what you did with your family. You denied me right in front of them. I hope you love them. Because your phileo love did not leave them, lead them to me. Now, that's a pretty tough thing to think about. But you imagine the flip side. You confessed me in how you lived with them. And do you see that after you died, one of them's going to change because of what you did? Because you confessed me. Doesn't that change the way we think about how we interact with our family? Doesn't it give us strength and hope? And at the same time, here's Jesus. He knew what that was like. Many of his family members don't change until after he ascends to the right hand of God. But he knew he did it right. Now, not every situation plays out that way, but I want you to understand what we're doing, living a spiritual mindset, walking with Christ now, doesn't just affect us. It affects the way God will use us even in the midst of our family, in our marriages, with our parents, with our children, with in-laws. And Jesus is putting that right in front of them. And we're not going to get to the payoff of this just yet. But hopefully next week, when we get to chapter 11, verse 1, I think you'll see something that's very beneficial. All right. Thank you very much. Have a good rest of the week.